This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. Lame duck congresses are a regular source of mischief. It's the longest possible time before another election, and many of your colleagues' votes could be easier to get after they, well, you know, lost. Jonathan Bidlack of the R Street Institute details this lame duck session that's coming at the end of a stunning spending streak by the president.
Based on where we are in a calendar, particularly an electoral calendar, we can have reasonable expectations about how Congress is going to behave. So we just had an election. The new Congress has not taken office yet. And then there's this window, the lame duck period. What do we typically see with regard to spending during a lame duck period?
Well, let me answer it this way. I mean, what do you think we're likely to see when we have a bunch of elected officials who just took office or were reelected, and they don't have 2 years until minimum until their next election? You know, you have an environment where there's a complete lack of accountability. You are the furthest away from the next flashpoint of accountability, your next election. And so that moment in time is the opportunity to do things that, if you want to think positively, maybe where there's the the political will to otherwise wouldn't be there. But it's also the opportunity to do things that there might not actually go and be approved by your constituencies. And so historically, the lame duck period, while we like to talk about it sort of making it easier to do some of the good things, tends to be the time that it's also the easiest to do a lot of the bad things. And so it tends to be that time when we end up going and seeing the biggest of the big spending bills coming down the pike.
And this comes at the end of, well, I don't even want to call it the end. We're just 2 years through term one, possibly, of a Biden administration. And President Biden is committed to spending hundreds of billions of dollars for student debt relief that Congress never approved, and is also, with regard to other spending, kind of off the rails. Even though we say that, and that's always true, it seems especially egregious right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the charitable term is unprecedented, and how you interpret whether that's a good or bad thing, I guess, depends on your view on the issues and the things that he's been spending on. But you know, the underappreciated part of the Trump presidency is that he spent a lot. I mean, he spent more than anyone had before in the last 2 years of his presidency. And of course, a lot of this was driven by COVID, but a lot of it was not. You know, there were massive increases, for example, in the Pentagon's budget, but Trump kicked into motion, according to official CBO estimates, something like $3.3 trillion in new spending that wouldn't have occurred otherwise. And now, you know, you have President Biden coming into office, and his first 2 years, and of course, we're at a later, you know, point in the pandemic as well. So perhaps some of that spending on COVID is less justified than it was 2 years ago. But we have President Biden now spending even more in those 2 years than Trump did in his last two. And you know, it's sort of an inconvenient topic that nobody really wants to hear, because you know, if you're a Republican, you don't want to talk about the fact that Donald Trump was the biggest spender and massively blew up the national debt even before COVID. And if you're a Democrat, well, you approve of a lot of the spending that President Biden has been doing. And so you don't really want to talk about that aspect of the Trump legacy either, and the ways in which Joe Biden has been continuing the Trump legacy during his first 2 years in office with respect to the nation's finances.
So what are we likely to see by the end of this lame duck session?
You mean besides continued inflation?
Well, I mean, I guess I mean big ticket items,
yeah,
that Congress doesn't want to feel accountable for.
Sure. So, I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, obviously we have the appropriations process, the so-called regular order. Congress never goes and you know, works on the appropriations in the way that they are theoretically supposed to, which is to, you know, take up or down votes on 12 individual bills. And so it's sort of become the norm to go and roll those in together into an omnibus. And that omnibus typically happens this time of year. So right now we have the government essentially being funded through December 16th based on the last continuing resolution that President Biden signed and at the end of September. And so The one open question, right, is what does the next funding bill look like to avert a government shutdown? That will be likely one of two things. It will either be that omnibus that I talked about, or it will just be a continuing resolution that continues the current levels of spending through the next year. You know, there are pluses and minuses again for to each of those options, depending on your perspective. But that's the most immediate thing. Beyond that, we have other things as well that have not been addressed. I mean, the National Defense Authorization Act, which essentially sets the Pentagon's budget for the next year, has also not been approved. And so that is also being worked on by Congress. And that will take a lot of work. And of course, that's a huge amount of spending. I mean, there's, you know, one of the proposals literally is now up to $850 billion, which is just mind-boggling if you really think about it, that we're closing in on $1 trillion a year for the Pentagon's budget. And so, you know, there's even talk now among Democrats of rolling together an omnibus and, you know, the NDAA, which reminds me of a comment that, you know, Justin Amash made years ago, that if Congress could, they would just take one vote a year up or down to do everything that they want to do. And then there would be no accountability. And it does seem like in the lame duck, we're moving in that direction. And then there are other things too. I mean, you know, the debt ceiling will need to be raised next year. And that's not necessary. That's still a ways away. But of course, Democrats are worried that they're not going to be able to go and get that increase, you know, in the future. And so they'd rather go and try to, you know, quote, deal with that now in the lame duck when they still have a Democratic majority. So it's possible we'll see that on the horizon. And then there's a whole host of other things that, you know, aren't even necessarily fiscally related. I mean, we've seen the vote on same-sex marriage. We have, attempts to reform the Electoral Count Act. So there's all of these other kind of things, too, that are also there in addition to these big fiscal packages.
How do Republicans with a straight face talk about fiscal responsibility at this point? Like in general, because I can't imagine, I know individual members of Congress say, hey, we need to worry about debt. I know Rand Paul pivoted in his election night victory immediately back to debt and spending. Broadly speaking, Republicans have lost whatever mantle they might have claimed to be able to be the spokesman for fiscal responsibility.
It is funny how that works, isn't it? But of course, you know, Republicans have been in this position before. I mean, at the end of George W. Bush's second term in office, they had arguably lost a lot of credibility on fiscal issues, and that didn't stop them from opposing the sort of, you know, big new spending packages that President Obama proposed when he first came into office. And in fact, that was what, you know, gave rise to the Tea Party movement on the right, and at least nominally a lot of concern about the rise in spending and the debt. So to some degree, I don't know that the irony will necessarily get in the way here, and that it will stop them from doing what may be in their political self-interest. I do think there is this interesting question, though, as to whether or not the current moment, even though we will have, you know, a Democratic president and Republicans having control of the House, is really analogous to what it was when, the Tea Party wave happened, right, in 2010. I mean, if you look at the infrastructure package as one example that was, you know, signed by President Biden last year, that bill, would spend or would set in motion basically $200 billion in spending more than what President Obama's stimulus package did back in the early 2010s. And so no one really seems to be worked up about that, though, in quite the same way. In fact, you know, the recent infrastructure bill is basically talked about as a compromise bipartisan piece of legislation, which, setting aside, you know, what good infrastructure spending looks like, it does seem like there really isn't the same level of, just getting worked up about it, not, you know, by the general press, but also even by Republicans. Republicans just don't seem to care as much about it as they do, as they did, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
And why is that? Is it just that we've just become numb to ever increasing spending and deficits?
I think that's part of it. I also think that, you know, to some degree, the Overton window has changed, and, you know, it's hard to go and, I guess, talk about this without talking about or discussing what I would say is the elephant in the room, which is Donald Trump. I mean, you know, President Trump, again, you know, he ran not on sort of the traditional Republican issues. You know, he was not Paul Ryan saying we need to reform Social Security, Medicare, and entitlements. I mean, in fact, he ran on the exact opposite platform, which is that I'm not going to go and do anything to fix these programs. And so I think that to some degree, what had been the traditional conservative position has basically moved. And if you look at where a lot of the groups on the right are on a lot of these issues, frankly, they don't seem to care much either. I mean, for a lot of the bluster that you hear from organizations like the Club for Growth or the Heritage Foundation, it doesn't seem like spending or budget policy or fiscal conservatism rises to the same level as some of the more immediate culture war type of issues. And so, again, like we can debate, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg here, I guess, but it generally speaking seems like both among the broader Republican base, but also the elites, there just seems to be less interest in those positions.
People who care about debt and federal spending are, I guess, used to the fact that so much of the federal budget is on autopilot. And more recently, we've seen pretty naked attempts, I think, by presidents of both parties to engage in a lot of spending without any congressional input whatsoever. Now, it's one thing for Congress to put things on autopilot. Their votes were taken at some point on these executive orders where spending is the key element. The White Houses are just trying to do it on their own.
Yeah. And, you know, that's been one of the most pernicious, I think, elements of the Biden administration's spending binge is that it's not just that, you know, yes, the president has been signing and enacting a lot of legislation that has been approved by Congress, right? That always happens. But there are a number of things that have been happening via executive order that also have significant budgetary implications and to a degree that's much greater than has happened in the past. And so, you know, the most prominent among those is the recent forgiveness of student loans, which, you know, the most recent pause, I think, has been estimated to cost something like $40 billion. But then, you know, the forgiveness beyond that is, you know, has a cost in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And then that is on top of, the CBO a couple months ago went and put out responded to a request from Republicans about the cost of President Biden's various executive actions. And they found that the cost of the ones that they reviewed, I think it was in June of this year, was on the order of over $500 billion. And so that doesn't even touch on the most recent student loan thing. So, you know, right there, you've got literally another $1 trillion in addition to a spending record that is already greater than what he's done together in concert with Congress. And that's really unfortunate, and it opens up a whole other can of worms beyond the budgetary issues, because as you point out, there's this question of sort of the balance between executive power and legislative power, and in a sense, you have the legislative branch just further ceding the power of the purse over to the Biden administration. And this is something that, you know, unfortunately, both parties love to play politics with. When President Trump was playing shenanigans with the border wall and trying to repurpose, funding for the Pentagon to build the border wall, you had Democrats up in arms over that, and rightfully so, because it was a complete power grab, regardless of your feelings on the policy. But now you have the burden on the other side, where you have President Biden coming and saying, you know, I'm going to go and do this stuff by executive order. And now a lot of those same Democrats tend not to care. So it's, such is politics, I guess.
But why do it when you have both houses of Congress?
I mean, to do just about anything these days, especially when you have a majority that's as narrow as the Democrats have had and in the Senate, you almost always have to have some level of bipartisan support. And so that's, I think, one part of the picture. The other is just that, you know, look, I mean, there is still a lot of disagreement within the two conferences or caucuses. And so, even though Democrats may have that majority, right? I mean, you also have to have the support of Joe Manchin or you know, Senator Sinema, for example. And so I do think that there is still some level of a check going on, even within the parties. And, you know, we know that there's a lot of diversity on the Republican side when you talk about a lot of these issues, too. And so, you know, just because the Democrats have had that majority and that majority has allowed them to enact a lot of big spending policies over the last 2 years, it doesn't mean that they're able to do that on everything. And so I think that's, you know, that's a big part of it. And then the last part is just, it's again, I think sometimes it's easier to do things via executive action, right? Or maybe you don't think that the Supreme Court will ultimately uphold the constitutionality of these particular actions, but it's a way to take an action that signals to your base and doesn't jeopardize the electoral viability of the members in your party in Congress. So there's a lot of things at play here, I think, that determine whether or not things are happening via executive order or via the legislative process.
Jonathan Bidlack directs the governance program at the R Street Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.